The time is 8:31 on January 30th, 2024, and I am convening this video conference and telephone conference meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the Association Antitrust Policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on January 18th, 2024 and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as 8 of the 9 directors have been confirmed as attending in person or by video or audio conference. Director Frigo was unable to attend the meeting. Also in attendance are General Counsel Jackie Rickson, TLHIGA Executive Director Bart Bowles, and TLHIGA employees Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty. And from the Texas Department of Insurance, we have Vane Hugo and Sean Martin. So agenda item number 1 is consideration of possible action on consent agenda items.
James Huckabee, motion to approve.
Frank Beamon, second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
I had one discussion.
Aye.
Wait, we have a discussion.
Under item 12, that was the correct date when we mentioned it. The board confirmed that its next meeting will be on January 23rd, 2024, which we subsequently approved to move it to today. So we need to, how do we note that?
So we can note the change, and then we've already done the change.
Yep. When you okay. Sign it. Right. We have made that change. It's not displayed, but we've made it in the certification that will be signed.
Okay. Do we need to re-vote, or is that good?
No, as soon as you ask. Anything
else? Yeah. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Y'all. Item number 2 is consideration of possible action on election of officers and the appointment of members to committees of the Board of Directors.
So, Mr. Chair, every January we have this election to appoint the 4 officer positions for the Board of Directors and then to appoint the ad hoc committees. We always provide you the language from the association's bylaws requiring or describing those positions. And please note that one officer position must be a public representative. And so I distributed the nomination guidelines to all directors on October 26th via email and asked for nominations for chair, vice chair, secretary, and treasurer. I received a number of nominations. Then I proceeded to have phone calls with all those that were nominated to make sure they'd be willing to serve in those specific positions. Those calls were completed, and what I'm displaying on screen are the final nominations that have been confirmed, and the directors are willing to serve in those positions. And there is a resolution on 2-4 of your material. When you're ready to consider those 4 positions, I'll let you have your discussion.
Do you need a motion?
I don't know.
Do you need a motion to approve the resolution? I move.
Let's fill in the positions. I leave it blank just in case there may be changes. But to clarify the resolution, the nominations that have been received and confirmed would be James Huckabee as chair, James Harrison as vice chair, Ted Kennedy as secretary, and Dean Frigo as treasurer.
I move to adopt the resolution as completed.
David Summers, second.
So, Kamala Summers?
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 And Jim, I'll note, just, I checked the participant list. Sandra Salazar is just from the Department of Insurance, has just joined the meeting. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you.
So, Jim, there are four standing committees. There's one continuing ad hoc committee in 2023. And the board should discuss the composition of those committees for 2024 and whether the ad hoc committee should continue. So I have those displayed on the screen. You can review.
The executive committee is automatic, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That we've just taken care of. And I believe Mr. Huckabee told me that taking over the position of chair, he would no longer be serving as chair of the personnel committee. So that will require some adjustment.
And I think Mr. Beeman does not currently serve on a committee.
We can fix that.
So much for flying under the radar. Would you like to be on the personnel committee?
I gladly serve wherever you need me.
Because I will go off the personnel committee if. Are you still going to be on the personnel committee?
Well, I would like to, but give others an opportunity.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll go off the personnel committee. I've been on enough committees. I don't need to be on one.
Well, to finish the personnel committee, is there a suggestion for a chair?
David Summer.
Did you know to ask him?
Yeah.
I'm willing to serve as chair.
Any changes to the audit or AI committee? Assessment convention. I shouldn't make that clear. That's.
Yes.
Assessment investment.
That's how we're replacing you. Does anybody else want to move around? Swap committees or something?
Let me see. Right now, we have one on the personnel committee. Do we need to finish populating that committee?
Well, I've written down David Summers agreed to chair, and then you would agree to continue as a member of the committee.
Yes.
And then Frank Beeman has agreed to join the personnel committee. And the others, I believe I'm hearing, would stay intact. The only other item to be discussed is whether the ad hoc governance committee, you need to remember that was created about a year and a half ago, or appointed a year and a half ago. We had a letter raising some governance issues from the Department of Insurance. Those have been addressed. And that committee has been available to monitor as those changes were implemented. Nothing has arisen.
Do we want to? Ted, do you have an opinion? Your chair.
I guess no proclivity necessarily one way or another, but if the work is done at the committee, I think normal protocol would say we dissolve the committee for now and reform at a future date if necessary.
That sounds reasonable to me. What do the rest of you think?
I had a year on there.
Patty, you're okay with dissolving?
Yeah, I think we did our job as updating whatever we needed to update.
Do we need, I can't remember what the plan is. Are we going to need some kind of committee for, I can't think of the term, succession?
We were going to talk about that when we get to that item.
Okay.
And you can decide at that point if you want to select a new ad hoc committee.
Okay.
But that doesn't have to be done right now.
Okay.
We need a motion?
Yes.
I'll move committee membership as we just discussed.
Ted seconds.
Any board discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Thank you very much. Okay, then item number three is the Personnel Committee.
Okay. Couple things on here, and on A, board would choose on the benefits, compensation, training component.
Yes.
Would you?
Yeah, the committee did review at their meeting on January 9th the various benefits, compensation, and training elements that we were going to include in the 2024 operating budget. As far as the benefits, there's no additional benefits, and the pricing on the benefits being afforded to the employees, namely health insurance plan, retirement, things like that. No changes from prior years, very much in line, no significant increases. Training elements, same elements in the budget we normally include for continuing training of staff. There were a few compensation adjustments that I recommended, and the Personnel Committee did sign off on for presentation to the Board of Directors. Since those are involving specific employees, I will discuss those in executive session. And if there are no disagreements with my recommendations that the Personnel Committee has already approved, that would be considered under the operating budget. I believe it's item 13 on the agenda. So when you approve the budget, you would be approving those changes. So that's all the benefits, compensation, and training, Mr. Huckabee.
Okay. We did execute the performance evaluation of the executive director. All of you received those, we will, I just say we had 7 of the 9 directors pass the evaluation. It came during a time several people were traveling, and we might, this is for the Personnel Committee, we might want to look at if we need to modify the due date for those evaluations. I believe they were due December. Jackie, was it 15? December 15th. And there were several people that were in the middle of a holiday travel. So we could discuss later how we might want to modify that date if we want to move by moving it up before the holiday travel. But we would discuss that in executive session. That's really it. And there is, so we'll have those discussions and any feedback, follow-up questions, we can address it during executive session. On the number,
on the executive director contract. That'd be the next item. Need to
We could can say in public session, right, what those, what that rating was, correct?
No. Executive session.
Okay.
I think the next item would just be some updates and reporting on various elements that have occurred under my contract. One is the committee didn't look at my performance in July, and I had met the requirements. So there was a longevity bonus paid to me in December. And then the contract allows for a cost of living adjustment in whatever is reported by the Social Security Administration for 2024. So there was a 3.2% increase in my base compensation that took effect January 1st. The only other element is a discretionary element. My contract provides for an additional $18,500 to be contributed into a 457B plan maintained by the association, owned by the association, but I do control the investments. The board has the discretion annually to look at my performance and decide whether they would like to increase that contribution to the maximum permitted by the IRS. So in 2024, the IRS does allow $23,000. So that is an item that can be discussed in executive session. Should I keep rolling? Or do you want to talk about the compensation consultant?
Well, do you keep rolling?
Okay. Well, the committee also discussed it at my request. The engagement of a compensation consultant to provide do a study of the three the three association positions other than mine. Normally, it's about every 8 years, and this would be the fourth time the association has done it. A compensation, the study is determined or is requested to look at the positions, their job descriptions, and the marketplace to see if the compensation and the salary range that is established for each position is appropriate for those responsibilities in today's marketplace. For several reasons, I asked the committee to accelerate that period, that between studies. It's only been 4 years, but I asked them to do it again. And my reasons, I said to the committee, were a very dynamic marketplace and Austin's changing a lot. We want to make sure that our positions are competitive. The responsibility for some of the positions and job descriptions are adjusting just a little bit. And the last thing is, as part of the succession, there's a couple of elements that should be considered there as the succession of both general counsel and my position are beginning. It does create a little bit of uncertainty for staff. This is a way to provide some confidence for them. At least they're being compensated fairly, and it's being looked at regularly. And the other thing is, whenever a new executive director comes in, this is one thing that won't be on that person's plate for a few years. Just get it out of the way now, and it can sit for a little bit. So I provided that rationale to the committee, and the committee did authorize me to proceed and develop it. So there will be an RFP developed and then distributed to a number of firms. We'll gather any proposals and present back to the personnel committee in July. Right now, there's no action required of the board, but should the personnel committee make a selection of a firm to conduct the study in July, the board will be asked to make an engagement. And if that follows according to plan, the study will be conducted in time to have the report ready at the October meeting for implementation, any changes as of January 1, 2025. So that's only a reporting item, but it is a little bit different from our normal schedule, but the committee did feel it made sense. And the last thing, if I could touch on the succession planning, we won't go into all the steps here. You know, my modus operandi for using the board and its committees, the legwork's done by the committee, and we don't repeat all those details with the board. This may be something in executive session that the committee wants the board to know a little bit more about, but Jackie and I did develop a quarter by quarter step-wise plan of the steps that we'd be taking in 2024 to identify, interview, select, and transition a general counsel into Jackie's role by her targeted retirement date of 12/31/24. And Jackie, if you could say something about your transition and how you might be available beyond that date.
Yeah, so what I told the personnel committee was that, you know, I do want there to be a hard stop at the end of this year, but I would be willing to be available into 2025, sort of on an as needed and as agreed upon basis. And I think, you know, what I would envision that would be is the new person, you know, is working on whatever it is they're working on, maybe something that they've never actually seen before in Guarantee Association land. And they would call me up and say, okay, what is this thing? You know, how does this work? And why is it this way versus the way it might be, you know, either in the industry or in bankruptcy or, you know, those kinds of things. So I wouldn't be actively, you know, drafting documents and negotiating agreements and that sort of thing. But sort of being the word that comes to mind for me is being a mentor to that new person, to the role.
So with respect to the general counsel succession, the board will need to decide what component of the board or the full board will be involved in that plan, in implementing these various steps. Should there be the personnel committee handling it? Should it be a specific transition planning committee or coordination committee, we can talk about that more in executive session, because we can add some details of what specific elements will need to be discussed. But we should do that today, because that work's going to kick off soon. And I can share for the entire board some of the specific steps to do this. But to find a replacement for Jackie after her 30 plus years with the association by the end of the year is a significant task. That's a lot to do. And it's important. I'll tell you, I'm going to be selfish, but it's very important to me because I rely on Jackie heavily. We talk every day.
Maybe it's for later discussion, but I would add it might be helpful for me and Ted or some of us that deal with all the regulatory lawyers. I mean, Jackie knows everybody. It's a very small pool of people, mm-hmm. especially if you want someone in Austin to do this work. So if yes. we could be an ad hoc personnel committee member, like I know probably of five people we'll end up interviewing, I'll know all five of them. I mean, most of these people have been doing this work. You don't want a new lawyer. You yeah. want someone with experience, relationships at the department that understand how the industry works. So it's not a giant pool of candidates. And so I would just raise my hand and say, if you need some additional help, I mean, between Ted and I and Brian, I mean, but I've been doing this 30 years. I know most lawyers who'd be probably qualified to even get through the RFP screening process.
So. And one of the things we did talk about at the personnel committee, Patty, was sort of contacting people who might know of people right. who would either be possible candidates or know people who would be candidates.
Well, so that might be even the easier thing. Here's a list of the top 10.
Yeah. So, and we certainly want like your involvement, Ted's involvement in that sort of effort too.
So, Mr. Chair, we could address that here. I'm not hearing anything coming up confidential right now. I want to postpone this. We could select the committee now. I will add to Patty's comment, and she inferred there's a process. This is not the normal. You post a job out publicly and or put it on the bulletin board over at the law school, and everyone coming out of school is going to apply for it. There's some specific expertise and knowing the lay of the land right. and some demeanor. And it's not a normal open posting. It's a search that's going to be a little bit more focused. Mm-hmm. And the committee, whatever committee is selected to work on this, will have a significant hand. So yeah. we can talk about that now. What yeah. kind of committee should it be and who should serve?
Sounds like a good idea.
Not that we could ever possibly come close to replacing Jackie or Dip. Thank God you oh, are willing to be a mentor for the next year. Because even if you find the best person, they're going to go, I've never seen this.
I know. Yeah.
And you don't want to pay some lawyer to spend 20 hours researching something that Jackie can answer in a minute.
Yes.
You know.
Right.
That makes a big difference. Anyway, sorry.
Does that mean you wanted to?
They want to have a committee. I think they're thinking about who should be on it. And let's let them think just a little bit. I think Patty has an idea and a suggestion.
So you appear to wish to be on the committee.
Oh, I'd be happy to participate. Okay. I just can.
I'm happy to participate. I have some ideas. I can either funnel those to the committee or participate on the committee. Either way, I'm happy to serve while I have the mic. I suppose it'll be a job for the committee, but Bart, as you correctly identify, this will be a select outreach for viable candidates. But just a quick query, based on the structure of our organization, is there also a requirement for this to be noticed publicly?
We'll have to do something that is public, Ted. Because it can't all be done by sort of in a closed process.
Yeah. In addition to the requirements, I would urge you not to do all this behind closed doors. It has a terrible mm-hmm. perception.
Right. Yeah.
As much as we can be transparent in this process, we should.
Yeah. So wouldn't you at a future board meeting say we've had these three firms as finalists and these are the ones we're considering and following up with or something like that?
Yeah. Well, I think the committee and then the board should consider actually having some kind of public posting or something because of the nature of the organization.
Yeah, that's my point.
And you just post it in the same place you post the meeting?
Yeah.
Announcements, the Texas Register or whatever? I don't know.
And you can put the qualifications that you're looking for, exactly. Which would screen out a lot of just general practitioners. You could say guarantee fund, you know, 10 years of experience in the insurance industry right there. Oh, good.
But I think that's something to work on, exactly how that's done, so that we don't end up with a flood of paper to deal with from people who are clearly not going to be qualified.
You're going to get that anyhow. Yeah. We can post a job with very specific qualifications, and people, you know, who've got 10 years of experience managing a restaurant will apply.
I just posted one, and I had someone, like a philosophy professor in New Jersey, apply. I was startled. It was very specific.
Is there any really thought on, and I think I picked up Patty's recent firm, I don't know if that was, engaging a search firm? For something like this?
We kind of talked about it some in the personnel committee, and we didn't think it'd be a good idea.
Good, because I'm not a it's not something that I've never had success with search firms.
The association has historically used search firms a couple of times, but only in the executive director position.
Yeah. Right. I think with a law firm, it's going to end up being 10 firms that are, frankly have that.
We'll probably reach out.
Well, we've had, as I understand, right, we've had two people volunteer for the committee. Another name be mentioned is almost was volunteered. Let me say something before anyone else decides that they want to serve. This is going to require a meeting before July. It's going to be have a meeting probably soon. There may be several meetings to work through this process and get into the minutiae and the details. So when you say you want to serve, you're going to be asked to do some work, so be prepared. So I've heard Patty and Ted, Mr. Harrison, your name was put out there. Are you willing?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know the Austin people as well, but I know the industry would be so.
And you know the skill set. Well, that's three. There's no requirement that it only be three.
But I mean, honestly, y'all have the most experience with Guarantee Associations, period. So I think y'all are very well qualified for it.
So what's the name of the committee? The General Counsel Search Committee?
Yeah, an ad hoc committee. Do we need a motion?
Yes, you do.
I move to create a General Counsel Search Ad Hoc Committee for the purposes of screening law firms and making a recommendation to the personnel committee. We go to the personnel committee and then to the board. Make recommendation to the board.
Yeah.
For our new relationship starting. Do we want to have an overlap, or is that something we'd recommend?
I don't think you need to be quite so specific in
just
motion.
Form the committee and we can do the details.
Okay. I make a motion to form an ad hoc general counsel search committee.
I'll second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
And who appoints the people to the committee?
You do.
I do. Okay, so we've done it.
Jim Harrison, Ted Kennedy, and Patty McCandless.
Yep.
And do we decide on a chair now or wait till the first meeting to decide on?
I'd rather have a chair because that's the person I'm going to talk to.
Okay.
Who will be serving as chair?
Does anybody wish to be a chair of the three individuals in the committee?
Me too. I vote for Ted unless Ted didn't want to do it.
Ted, you have been voted.
Do you want to be chaired?
It doesn't pay to be absent. No, I'm happy to do it.
Well, thank you, sir.
All right. That's all we have for that item, Mr. Chair.
We were going to make Dean in charge of everything.
Oh, too late.
So I'm sorry to go back here, but did you make a...
Oh, I'm sorry. I need to comment on your contract.
Well, did I miss this, or was there a resolution on the board committees?
There was.
There was.
Yeah. Yes. You said you made me pause and think. Under this item, let me see this.
I forget.
Oh, no, it's a separate item.
You
know, it's okay.
You need a resolution on the. No, it's who gets appointed to the committees, right?
Yeah, and you Bart just said you all did that already.
Yeah.
So we must have.
Yep, we've done that.
And I'm not saying because I care because I'm chair, but I thought the chair appointed people to committees.
You do, but it's normally we just recognize them as a resolution.
Okay.
But you're right. It is an appointment.
And it's going to be your job in the future. But It's the only reason I was bringing it up.
What used to be called the AI committee is now the Assessment Investment Committee is the next item on the agenda.
Yes. So on to item number four. Consideration, possible action on reports and recommendations from the Assessment Investment Committee.
Okay, I'm still going to refer to it as the AI because assessment investment is too hard to say. We did meet on January 9th compared to recent meetings. This one was pretty routine, but there was one action item arising out of the committee's work. We reviewed the remaining policy obligations for active insolvencies. We do have sufficient funds on hand. Reminder, the liquidation order for Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers is still on appeal, so that's going to obviously shake things up here in the future. The current investments, we reviewed those. The Friday insolvency did lead to some minor investment management changes in order to adjust to address claims obligations arising from Friday, but I think Bart's going to get into that more later, so just defer that conversation or discussion until then. Investment policy, we reviewed, no changes recommended there. And lastly, we looked at assessments and potential assessments and refunds. No Class B is necessary at this time. As mentioned, we have adequate funds on hand. With respect to, I guess, a Class A, we did talk about that. We will need to fund the association's 2024 general and administrative expenses. In lieu of a Class A, however, the committee recommended that we fund 2024 expenses through the insolvency expense account. This is essentially the same pot of money that we use to pay the 2022 and 2023 administrative expense, I think all through the 21 shortfall.
Yes.
And there is a resolution to that effect on 4-2, I believe.
Yes.
And that would be the only action item for the AI committee. Or if you want to provide any more color.
No, that's very good. Just ask, are there any questions? And Jarrett, you might say the operating expense budget, which is really what we anticipate would be these admin expenses, is approximately how much?
$2.4 million.
Now, in that, we always like to explain, you've got your operating overhead, but then there's also what would have been a Class A assessment for any trouble company monitoring expenses before activation. So once, let's say, for example, Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers, we have expenses that we're incurring on those and working on those and paying NOVA task force expenses. They are being paid out of administrative expenses. Once we are activated, if we are activated for those insolvencies, and we do a Class B assessment, Class B assessments will include those amounts and repay the admin expense fund. So there are insolvency amounts in there, but they are for troubled companies that we have not yet been activated. So don't think there's $2.4 million of operating overhead here. It's about half that.
You want to pull up the resolution, Bart?
A motion.
Frank Newman, so moved.
James, Ted.
Get James first. Beat him to it. Sorry, Ted, he beat you to it.
It's what happens when you're not here.
Okay, it'll be discussion. Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. And so just to make sure, item number five, consideration possible action regarding any matters presented by the Texas Department of Insurance. And the notes say that you have nothing to discuss in open session. Is that
very short update? We have nobody on the horizon for you.
Like that.
Oh, that's been really last year.
That's the best report I've heard.
Yeah. Okay, and agenda item number six, quarterly report from Executive Director.
Yes, sir. This will be very brief. Just a couple of things to update you on. I left this first item in report, the access to the ICANN system. Bain knows that we've been talking or have been talking with Jamie Walker about this, but with the health insurance insolvencies we're working on in 2024, we just absolutely had to back burner this. We just could not get to it right now. We will resume it in 24 when we get our head above water. There are only so many resources here, and we have to kind of pick and choose our projects. But this is going to require a little bit of work, a little bit of effort. But if we can get the data and can use it, it's going to save a lot of time and be very helpful. The rest of this is just about some meetings that have happened. I will be chairing the IAR resolution workshop that will be held April 10th, 11th, and 12th in New Orleans. I've already developed the agenda, and for over three quarters of the panel's invitations have already been sent out and accepted for presenters. So I'm trying to get that finished early this week. And then by February 15th, we'll finalize any tweaks to the topics and start promoting that workshop, and the room block will be opened. The rest of this, NEIC meetings, I did attend the NEIC meeting that was held in Orlando at the end of November, early December. And then I will be attending the NEIC spring meeting in Phoenix, March 15th. I put through the 19th. I'm actually going to have to leave there on the 18th because I'll be leaving San Diego to go, Phoenix to go to San Diego for the ILTCI conference. I did not put that on here, but that is a long-term care companies conference. It's about 5,000 people that attend. They're involved in the long-term care community, and I've been attending that for several years now. NOLGA meetings. The NOLGA MPC meeting was held in the end of October in Salt Lake. And then I attended the first MPC meeting of this year. It was held recently in Tampa. A lot of work has gone into not only some of these new trouble companies we're working on, like Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers, but there's some transition going on within NOLGA and the structure with Katie Wade coming in as the new president. So at the meeting that was held in Tampa, we did have a full afternoon of a strategic planning session with all the guarantee associations putting forth ideas. And it was led by a professional moderator. And I think we came to some suggestions of how we might change the structure. First, we have way too many committees, a lot of overlap, and we're trying to streamline what we're doing. A lot of you or some of you may have been exposed or heard me talk about the Quest system, where we keep a lot of our data on our insolvencies, and we move claim lodges and policy order list and confidential task force information. This is a SharePoint site that NOLGA maintains. It's voluminous and it's cumbersome, and it's going to be redesigned. And the other thing, redesigned, the NOLGA website is going to be redesigned. So a lot of good thought is coming out of this change in leadership. It's time for a fresh look at our national organization. And the last thing I'll mention there is the Western State Administrators. There are 13 states in the Western State Administrator Group, and we rotate the meetings around those states. And for many years, Hawaii got overlooked. And Peter Inouye, the executive director in Hawaii, travels to all these NOLGA meetings and does a lot of travel coming from Hawaii. So last August, we did have our Western State Administrators meeting in Waikiki. This year, we've decided the other person that travels a lot is Don Thomas from Anchorage, Alaska, and said, Don, we're going to let you stay home this year. So we are going to have our meeting in August at the Alyeska Report in Girdwood, which is about 50 miles from Anchorage. So I will be attending that. And it's interesting that a number of the administrators in the other regions have contacted us and say, can we come to your regional meeting? So we made a little room for them. But it's always good because in these regional meetings, we sit down and talk about some of the challenges we have in our operations and what techniques are you using? How does that work? Show me. And we share resources and skills. And it's always helpful. And we invite the NOLGA staff to participate, and they like to hear from the front lines, what do you guys really need from us? So those are the meetings and activities that will be coming up. And there are not any questions. That's all item six, Jim.
Okay. Item seven is consideration of possible action on the annual review of the Board of Directors fiduciary duties and the role and contact information for general counsel.
Do you want to start with that? Jackie, do you want to start with the fiduciary?
Sure. Yes.
Okay, give me just a moment. Okay, can everyone see that now?
Yes.
I'm sorry, it's got two up there. I'll try to make this a little bit bigger. Okay, Jackie, was that the first page? It was.
Okay. So the fiduciary duties of the board, we'll be happy to know, have not changed since last year. So nothing new for you all to remember. This is a new pressure. And the source of the fiduciary duties actually are more rooted in nonprofit corporation law in Texas as opposed to the Guarantee Association statute itself. The statute itself doesn't say anything about fiduciary duties. We do have a statutory requirement about conflicts of interest, which you all might be aware of. And that does, I would say, dovetail with the fiduciary duties that come out of Texas nonprofit corporation law. And it is likely that were a court to be looking at what are the fiduciary duties of a board of directors like this one, they would impose the duties that are found in the nonprofit corporation law in Texas, because we are so similar to those kinds of entities. So you might be wondering, what exactly is a fiduciary duty? And basically, it's the director's duty to act in the interest of the organization rather than in their own interest or in the interest of their company, if you're a company member. And Texas nonprofit corporation law identifies three fiduciary duties. You can flip over to the next slide, Bart, please. And the duties are the duty of care, the duty of loyalty, and the duty of obedience. And if these seem like they sort of overlap, they do. So the duty of care really requires that directors stay informed and exercise ordinary care and prudence in the management of the organization. And what this means is that the directors are to act in good faith with ordinary care and in a manner that he or she reasonably believes to be in the best interest of the organization. It does not mean that a director has to directors are the standard for conduct is the business judgment rule. So long as directors exercise reasonable due diligence in making decisions, it doesn't mean that every decision has to be correct or over time has to be rendered correct. It means at the time the decision was made, the directors were thoughtful about it, considered the appropriate information, advice of professionals such as, you know, counsel and auditors and actuaries and other people like that. Okay, next slide, please, Bart. And the duty of loyalty is somewhat similar in that the directors need to act for the benefit of the organization and not for their own personal benefit. And I think this is where It most dovetails with our statute where we have the interested transactions that would constitute a conflict of interest of a director. And you'll note there that interested transactions are prohibited unless they comply with our conflict of interest policy and board approval of the interested transaction is received. And then any information about that transaction must remain confidential. And we have not had actually, we have had interested transactions come up before with directors, mostly in the context of a company is under some kind of regulatory oversight by the department, and a director who's an industry member, their company is interested in assuming the business or a block of business of that company. And so a lot of times those really don't even rise to the level of guarantee association because those transactions occur before rehabilitation or liquidation. If a transaction were to come up within rehab or liquidation, then that the director involved would be an interested director and would need to recuse him or herself from any discussions and decisions having to do with that transaction. And then the last duty is the duty of obedience. And this requires directors to remain faithful to and pursue the goals of the organization and in avoid ultra vires acts. And ultra vires basically means acting outside of the scope of authority. And so directors, you know, obligations or their responsibilities are to carry out the functions of the statute. And so acting outside of that or the other governing documents of the organization would be a violation of the duty of obedience. And this slide has to do with, well, what actually happens then if there is an allegation that a director breached a fiduciary duty or other obligation under the Act? And there are three shields available to protect directors from personal liability. First one is the statutory immunity that's in 463.005, which is our governing statute. And this protects directors from good faith acts or omissions. And the operative word here is good faith, because any intentional acts or omissions or bad faith acts or wanton and willful acts are not going to protect the director. Next, the plan of operation in Section 8A has an indemnification provision, which extends to directors. And it includes the guarantee association paying legal fees and expenses for the director's defense in a lawsuit. And again, it does not extend to conduct that's intentional, not in good faith, or is criminal activity. And lastly, the guarantee association has a director's and officer's liability policy with a $5 million annual aggregate limit and a $5,000 retention. Does anybody have any questions about any of this? Okay. So as you know, with the retirement of board counsel, those responsibilities have basically been folded into the general counsel role. And in years past, you've seen what the duties of the general counsel are. And this is expanded just a little bit to include those board counsel roles. And the primary addition then is assisting the board in complying with statutory and common law duties and corporate governance and, you know, policies and procedures. And a lot of the other things that were specific board counsel roles were things that I also did, but perhaps not as visible to the board because the board counsel provided those services directly to the board.
I think those are shown more here.
Yes, there's another page.
Second page.
Yes.
Sorry that chopped off there. It's all right. Conversion somehow.
It's all right. And I would say that I think as, you know, as we go forward, the board may encounter issues or instances where they believe that they need counsel separate from the general counsel, or they need additional resources besides the general counsel, and those to be taken up as they arise, and the board can decide, you know, what kind of additional person or resource do they need to assist.
And Jackie, I'll add, we're going through these slides and there's a lot of very valuable information in here. And we're not expecting you to hear this once a year and say, I got it. I'm going to clean up a few of these slides. They are going to be posted on the board portal. So if you ever have questions, what are my fiduciary duties here? Or what are the duties of Jackie as general counsel? And how do I contact her? That's about to come up. They're going to be on the portal and you can go look at them at any time. Okay.
Yes. And then the last slide is just my contact information, which my phone numbers have not changed in a long time. My mailing address has changed recently, and then my email is that. And also, if you forget all of that, you can Google me because I have an unusual enough name and you can find me quickly.
The information there in red, please don't disregard that. You can contact Jackie anytime directly. There is no reason you need to come through me. Your communications to counsel do not have to be filtered or screened. Counsel is available to you directly at any time.
And that's all I have on that, unless anyone has any questions or comments.
Oops, sorry.
That is for number seven.
I'm getting there. Give me just one moment to switch.
Oh.
That's all for seven. Ready for eight. Yes, sir.
Okay. Consideration possible action regarding the annual evaluation of general counsel and engagement.
And Jim, here, since this is going to be a confidential evaluation, I just wanted to touch on the process that was used and that what was gathered and how it was distributed, and a little bit about Jack's engagement. So I did distribute an evaluation form to all the directors on December 22nd, and I did receive responses from all directors, and I prepared a compilation, and I will have that ready to display in executive session. I also distributed that to all the directors so they could read the comments anonymously that I've gathered onto the compilation. So we will address this in detail in executive session. As far as Jackie's engagement, you can see on 8-1, you can see the engagement letters that have been in place with Jackie from 2003, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, and 21. Her engagement letter, current one, just expired December 31st. And with our transition and succession work that we're ensuing, I asked Jackie to provide us with a new engagement letter just for 2024. So I have that, and we will review the terms of that letter in executive session. And any action on that engagement, we will take up after executive session. There's no action to be taken here. Just, are there any questions from the board on this process or Jackie's engagement in general? And that's all for that item, sir.
Okay. Number nine is consideration and possible action on corporate governance issues.
Okay, a couple items here. The first is, as you know, 2 years ago, we did do away with our annual self-evaluation of the board of directors. We've gone to an ongoing process where there's an item on the agenda for every board meeting where we can discuss any feedback from directors. And when I distribute the material for the board meeting, I solicit feedback. If there are any issues that a board member wants to bring up, please let me know in advance of the meeting so we can make sure we discuss it, but also to screen it. Can it be handled in open session, or do we need to handle it confidentially in executive session? So I did distribute that request soliciting any feedback, and I had no items suggested, but that does not mean a director cannot raise something from the floor. So are there any issues that a director would like to raise on corporate governance? Hearing none, I'll move on. These last two items is in review of two pieces of our corporate governance documentation. One is a business continuity plan. It's an important document that details a lot of the key information and relationships of how the association operates. And should a certain business interruption event occurs, you can go directly to an action plan on how to address that interruption. I review that plan annually to see if we need to do an update. I'll let you know, I also chaired the business continuity plan model subgroup for NOLGA. And last year, we revised the NOLGA model business continuity plan that had not been touched in 12 years. And so we have a new plan out there. And in doing that, I got a lot of suggestions from the committee I formed. And I compared the results of that model back to ours. And I just had nothing that we needed to update in ours. The only changes this year were what I call non-substantive. A few phone numbers for some of our vendors, some of our account reps on the vendors. That doesn't require board action. That's just normal maintenance of the business continuity plan. But we have no material changes to recommend this year. And the last item there is the critical functions report. That's some 35, 40 page report that if you were to look at the policy and procedure manual, the business continuity plan, and the critical functions report with the pointers that are in there to the various corporate governance documentation, you can pretty much run this association. The critical functions report is what I like to call as a brain dump. Day to day, what are the critical things we need to do? And then throughout the year, and at what frequency? And who in the office is involved in that? What do I do? What is Topping? What does Jarrett do? What does Brandy do? And when we carry out these various functions, what are the tools we use? Do we have checklists? Do we have spreadsheets? Do we have other people that we involve? So it's kind of a how-to guide on carry out the critical functions. So we look at that, or I look at that and read through it annually to say, okay, has something changed? Have we changed any of our critical functions? This year, there were not. I do want to look at it now that we're kind of putting toward the end of the tail on Friday and we're at the beginning of the tail on Bright. I want to look at it with a little closer eye, very carefully, about some of the health insurance obligations, health insurance handling. Because we have additional tools now that we're developing to work on those insolvencies. I want to make sure we reference them properly. But I don't have a change this year. This is forewarning. I'm probably going to have some updates next year. And that's all I had on item 9. Unless there are questions.
Item 10 is consideration possible action regarding the impaired and solvent member insurers matters related thereto.
Why the association is here, the meat of the matter. Let's talk about a little summary where we are. Right now we have 21 active receivership estates. And those are receiverships that are still ongoing in the various jurisdictions. That doesn't mean we're only maybe addressing obligations or talking to consumers and policyholders in those 21. There are activities that we have ongoing on closed receiverships, but we still have obligations. Just telling you there are 21 active receiverships that we work on out there. We did have one new activation since the last board meeting on November 29th. Bright Healthcare Insurance Company of Texas was placed in liquidation here in Texas. And the association was activated. I'll provide some details on that when we get into the specific insolvencies I'm going to discuss here. We still have three additional companies that we're monitoring. They're in rehab proceedings or some type of supervision proceeding in another state, or a liquidation petition has been entered, but it's not yet final, is pending against those companies. So for the obligations, the financials for this meeting closed at the end of November. So for the 11 months in 2023, ending November 30th, we had funded $19.2 million of policy obligations to the Texans we protect. We have approximately $18.9 million as of November 30th of obligations we're projecting on active insolvencies. Please note, when you look at that schedule, if you want to look at it, it's on 10-3. Bright Healthcare Insurance Company was added to that list, but there are no amounts in there. I really don't want to do a scientific guess. I'd rather do something that's based on knowledge and information. I just don't have information yet. So there are no numbers on there yet for Bright. And Fridays, I have a $6.5 million obligation. That's a little bit soft. That is going to take shape as we get a little further toward the end of that liquidation. Recoveries in for the first 11 months of 2023, $8.3 million in distributions. I'll mention a Friday distribution later that we did receive, but not until December 9th, so after the financials closed. And then also on 10-4, the communications report summarizing website and email activity for the fourth quarter of 2023, and our complaint log, which shows no complaints received in 2023. So let me begin and move into specific insolvencies. Let's first talk about Bright Healthcare Insurance Company of Texas, the first, the newest impairment liquidation.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yes.
Why do we have an open one from 1999?
Because the receivership is still open. They have not closed it.
Okay. Yep. There's still policies that we're taking care of?
They're not policies. Those are just active receiverships. We have to monitor it because we still have potential recovery from that. So it's an active receivership. And sometimes those receiverships, there might be ongoing litigation. There might be a tax issue. There might be an asset, piece of real estate with a problem they can't liquidate. The receiverships can go 30 years. They don't often in Texas because the special master just pushes them to closure. But in the other states, sometimes they languish.
There's no limitation.
No
time constraint. These are all judicial proceedings, and it's up to the court. Okay, so Bright Healthcare Insurance Company of Texas. I provided some of the background there. You can see that Bright, and I'll call it Bright Texas just to be short. Bright Texas was one of a number of insurance companies that were part of the Bright Health Management and the Bright Health Group. There's actually 12 other companies, but all 13 of these companies were managed and controlled by Bright Management, and operations were being performed by Bright Health Management. Now, this is different than what we experienced in Friday. They did engage an outside third-party commercial TPA, thank goodness. But there were a number of vendor relationships that were direct relationships, not of Bright Texas, but Bright Management Company. And I'll talk about those in a minute, but let me just mention the policies. All of Bright's policies were terminated, the exchange policies, December 31st, 2022. And there were some 321,000 of them. So since then, what's been happening is the runoff on the policies. And with the time reporting requirements on those policies for in-network and out-of-network, what we're seeing is when we got involved November 29th, is most of the claims had already been reported and paid. We're anticipating we're going to have about 5,000 claims. Comparing to Friday, we've already done 143,000 claims. So we don't think we're going to have that many, and maybe a few hundred appeals, but we'll see how it plays out. There may be something, you know, laying in the weeds we don't know about. The TPA that we're looking at, Evolent Health, was the TPA for Bright Texas before liquidation. The Texas Department had talked with Bright Management because Evolent Health was administering five of the Bright companies. And the department urged strongly, I believe, that agreement get an addendum added to it to separate the Bright Texas business. So there was an addendum specifically for 2023 for the run out of the Bright Texas business. We have been able to go in there and enter into negotiations, and we have a contract in place that I'm going to ask you to affirm later with Evolent for the 2023 run out and a contract from January 1 through 2024 for the 2024 run out. What that required is that the association pay $2.37 million under the 2023 contract, and then we will pay $2 million in total for the 2024 contract. So $4.37 million for the administration of this business. We had to work very diligently with Bright and with Evolent to identify the other vendors involved in the business. There was a company called Clear Health that was providing the out-of-network pricing with their network. So any out-of-network claims, they terminated their relationship with Bright. We contacted them and resurrected it. And just yesterday, through DocuSign, I executed a new agreement with Clear Health on very favorable terms. And they will have the runoff pricing on our out-of-network claims. We're having a call on Thursday to hopefully enter into a contract with another vendor that was working, was contracted directly by Bright Group. That is a company called Availity. They were the entity that were receiving the electronic submission of provider claims. And then they would assemble what's called an 837 file and transmit that to the TPA for processing. So we had to enter into an agreement with them. Some of the other vendors involved in handling mail and submission of claims and disputes, a company called MPX, another company called Smart Data Solutions. We did not have to enter into separate contracts with them because they are contractors of the TPA. So that was very helpful. So what else do we have to do? Looking at the manner in which they processed and specifically paid the benefits to providers and members was different in this insolvency. The adjudication was done and a file was assembled by a company called InstaMed, which is owned by Chase Bank. And that file was communicated to the Chase Bank account for Bright Group. And that file that was communicated had all the details for distribution of electronic payments to providers. But that went out of a Bright Group account that was commingled with monies from the other Bright entities. We couldn't do that. We're not going to put our money into a commingled account with entities that we don't control. So we do have our banking relationship with Chase. So we've set up a new bank account with Chase, but we had to do it under a new platform. Years ago, we used a platform called JP Morgan Access. And just a few years ago, and Jared can tell you when, but we changed to a different platform called Chase Connect. A little bit different. We don't issue checks. They're issued by Chase, and it limits how many electronic transactions we can do. And it's a little more advantageous and cost efficient for us. For these payments to go out from our bank account, and it's a lot of electronic payments, we had to resurrect the Access platform.
I have a question.
Yes.
We just have the bank mail checks. I mean, you don't have to pay the providers electronically. Is it cheaper? Is it that much cheaper?
Or? It is cheaper.
Okay.
It is cheaper. Much more efficient, much cheaper. So we've already set up the new bank account. It's in place. Jim Lewis has done the signature card for it. It just has to have a director be a signature. It does not have to be the chair. So we have all that in place. There's a few things in the testing that we have to complete. And there's a few things in an artifacts file, which is some of the instructions, because we had to redraft the instructions and information that goes out on the electronic, the EOP and the EOB. EOPs go to providers, EOBs go to members. And we didn't change the information on there because provider disputes and member disputes are handled differently here. Provider disputes go to one post office box in Maine, and member disputes go to a different post office box in Maine, are handled by different entities. Well, we now had to get control of that. We have. hard copy claims, where are they being sent? We've got that under control. I mention this because I don't care if it's a health insurance insolvency with 150,000 claims or 5,000 claims. On the front end, you've got to run down all these rabbit trails, execute a lot of agreements, do a lot of negotiations, and put a lot of things in place. It's a lot of work. We're almost there. And I mentioned this in our preparatory call with the Department of Insurance. On any health insurance insolvency, there's not going to be anything paid for about 90 days. To get everything in place where we have control of the claims processes, we have control of the funding, and we can properly send out information, takes about 90 days. We're 9 weeks into Bright, and we think we're 2 weeks away from getting payments on the street. Claims processing should resume next week.
So, can I ask a question, Bart? So we anticipate there's just about 5,000 claims left?
That's what we're hoping.
But it seems high, the $2 million for Evelyn for 5,000 claims.
They also will handle all appeals, member disputes and disputes. Appeals. Exactly. On claims, on provider appeals, we're going to handle them, but on their system, okay. We have view rights to go in and look at the information. They also will do all 1099 processing and filing. So I will say it this way. I mentioned that you do the same amount of work if you had this volume or this volume. With TPAs, you get to a base level just to have the platform available. There's a fee, no, irrespective of what volume goes through. And that's what we hit. We hit a floor.
Right. And it's easier to stick with the same administrator. But
the other issue we face too is that, you know, by the time the company is in liquidation, all of the So they're not going to make you a deal. You know, they're going to make you the best deal for them. That's
pretty sweet, $2 million for 5,000.
They're worried about getting paid.
Yes.
So, and we put them through some paces. They've been doing a lot of work, a lot of calls with us. But the good thing is also for the providers and the consumers, to the extent we do not change how they submit, we've left that in place. Mm-hmm. The only thing is we had to develop a provider dispute form, which we have. Topping will be posting it this week on our website. Providers could submit claims electronically, but not their disputes. The disputes were hard copy mail. So we've just replicated that. We've given them a higher form and where they mail it. So we don't know that there's going to be that many. It's greatly reduced from what we experienced on Friday.
Yeah, because coverage ended again 12/31/22. So this is just run out or people who are not happy about what they got paid.
And they did have some non-exchange business that terminated 7/31.
That weird small group stuff.
This wasn't even
off exchange.
Off exchange.
It continued.
Off exchange.
Okay.
So,
most mess.
It is.
You know what it's like to try to take over a health insurance claims operation in a short period of time. It's, you'll pull your hair out.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So just to understand succession planning kind of stuff, how much of this stuff is executive director attorney handling versus Jarrett and Topping? Are they getting involved in it? Because I know it's your first health insolvency, right? So I know you're doing a lot of new things, but
okay.
I don't know, is that the kind of thing that when we hire an executive director, they should know how to do it?
They either have to know how to do it or not find someone.
Find someone. Okay.
So a lot of the decision making and the chasing down, here's the way things are processed. That's me.
Okay.
That's my experience. And I talk with Jackie about that. And we make sure, okay, is there anything in there that we are concerned with legally? And can we reduce that to a contract? And then Jackie and I handle negotiations.
Okay.
Then once we set up a process and here's going to do what, Jarrett controls a lot of the claims reporting, testing, and funding. Topping, she's front lines on several things. Document control, to make sure, what are we getting in the door and have we got it on a checklist and are we staying on top of it? And then also customer service.
Okay.
Anything that comes in here, any inquiries and calls, because we get a lot of calls in these situations and the caller doesn't even know what they're asking. And you have to kind of walk them through, okay, you were covered by these people. You went to this doctor. What's going on? They sent you something. Well, I'm due a refund. Premium refund? Claims payment? We had one just last week. There was an overpayment to the provider. Well, provider owes them a refund, not us. Go talk to your doctor's office. So that's the way that, and it's not like Topping does their thing and I don't know about it. We talk a lot. Jackie and I talk a lot. There's group, we get everybody together and say, where are we on these projects? Let's make sure we're staying on top of this and organizing so we don't step on each other's toes and we're consistent. That falls on me.
Okay.
To coordinate that.
Bart, one suggestion I might have in light of this conversation and succession and how Friday was like the new world, or, you know, the world has changed since last time you had a health insurance. One idea for NOLGA, because they have the resources, it's put together some basic, like availability. You know, if you're on my side, everybody knows availability. That's right. How everybody submits data. You know, just some basic concepts for some of these.
Yeah, who some of these firms are and what they do.
You use one firm for out of network negotiations or contracting. You have a network that you either build yourself or you outsource. You've got TPAs you use, paid clients. Some of this stuff might be helpful for NOLGA to put together like a roadmap or something so that these aren't such a shock.
Let me touch on that when I'm about to go to Friday, okay. Because we're doing some of that on Friday. Bright Health, NOLGA's not involved.
Right.
There's no other guarantee association involved. We're doing this all ourselves. If any of the other Bright companies were to move into liquidation,
NOLGA would get involved.
They're probably going to get involved because those other associations don't have, is this going to sound wrong?
The infrastructure.
They don't have the infrastructure and the expertise that we have. We can handle it ourselves.
Right.
I'll talk about it in Friday.
Okay.
I've been around this a long time, but I will tell you the exchange, a new exchange insolvency was very different.
Mm-hmm.
Very different. So it's.
And there are pockets within the NOLGA system that where people know a lot about health insurance.
Yeah.
But it's much more heavily, you know, on the expertise of life and annuities.
Right. And the only distinction for it being an exchange insolvency versus off is primarily because of the risk adjustment obligation to the federal government. Other than that, all these health insurers, and hopefully there won't be others, but the reason these guys went insolvent is because they underestimated their risk obligation.
Right.
Outside of the exchange, you don't have that looming financial obligation, but operationally, outside the exchange, are all going to run basically similar.
Well, the big thing I saw from the health insurance insolvencies we used to handle a lot into what we're seeing today is there are so many different vendors involved, and primarily because of the electronic component that wasn't there years ago.
And some of these newer companies outsource way more. I'll tell you my word.
They outsource too much.
Most of these functions are done by my company, other than availability is a common platform that everybody uses.
So, Jim, before I go to Friday, first I want to ask if there are any questions on Bright, then I'm going to ask for some authority on Bright. Because we need to move forward.
A question on Bright.
Yeah.
Being it was one that had the exchange that you worked with. Was there, and I may have asked this, or you had a discussion about the potential tax obligations, tax credits for those that had, is there any liability there at all? Or if someone had purchased and received the tax credits, those tax credits, there's some funds that are possibly at risk.
You're talking about the subsidies that the members have,
right?
Okay. And they get a 1095 that tells them this is what.
Yeah.
So all of that, because this business had terminated before we were ever involved, falls on the company had already done before liquidation, and then the receiver to complete. We do kind of stay in touch with them. Okay, who's sending out the 1095s? There's also a 1095A. There's a 1094 A and B. And we help coordinate through the TPA who's doing this. For example, I ask about the 1099s for 2023, because a lot of claims got paid in 2023. We didn't pay a dime. But I know under the contract that Evelyn has responsibility to do that. Has anyone asked them? Because this deadline is like tomorrow, getting it out the door. And so I went to my contact for the SDR. I went to our contact at Evelyn, and they said, no, we sent them months ago. So there are some things like that we have to coordinate on, but on those premium subsidies and reporting and the tax implications in these recent insolvencies, because the terminations, the policies that all terminated before we got there, we don't have any involvement in it. And if there's anything left to do, it's the receiver, the SDR, that has to do it.
Hope they sent them days ago, not months ago.
Yes.
Sorry.
I said months.
Sorry, it was days, last week. Okay, so I mentioned in this draft resolution, there were a couple of things that we've had to do to get the ball rolling, and that is an agreement with Evolent Health and agreement with Clear Health Strategies. But at the very end of this, it says, into other agreements with vendors as deemed necessary, because we're still trying, when we're writing this, still trying to chase down everyone. The only other vendor to date I've identified that we're going to need an agreement with is Availity. And we have a final conversation about, they've already agreed they would work with us. We haven't seen their pricing. We know structurally how they were priced it. But until we have this final call on Thursday on all, everything that we're expecting of them, we're not going to finalize the agreement. We're thinking that this resolution will give us the necessary authority to move forward, get the claims being processed and claims being paid. This should encompass everything we need to get right underway.
Okay, I move to adopt the resolution.
I'll second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Very much.
Okay, let's move on and talk quickly about Friday. Quick contrast, and how is this different from what we just talked about on Bright? There were six Friday companies. Friday Health Insurance Company was the Texas-only company. It was placed in liquidation March 23rd, 2023. Again, all of its 304,000 exchange policies had terminated 12/31/22. There was some small group non-exchange business that continued past our appointment and liquidation date, but they terminated all by June 2023. So there were no issues there. So we were entering into the Friday runout at a very different place on the tail of the runoff. We knew there were a lot of claims to be addressed and a lot of appeals and disputes. We also knew that this company, most of the administration was being formed by the management company on behalf of the insurance companies, and they did not use a TPA. They had a lot of outside vendors that they used for different services. And within that management company, not only were they doing all the work, but they had all the employees, had all the equipment. The insurance companies owned none of the equipment and had no employees. They were virtual companies. So we had to enter into an arrangement with the management company, and we engaged them as under an administrative services agreement to do this administration. We didn't get that done until early May. And then we found out in June, when the other five states were beginning to consider take action to liquidate their companies, the receivers in those states said they would not use the management company to perform administration. The management company, without the fees from the other insurance companies to do the administration, said we can't survive. And July 7th, they closed their doors. Our administrative agreement was gone and dead. So we worked with the receivers in the other states and went to the company that was providing the administration platform, UST HealthProof. They're also a TPA, and we were able to enter into a service agreement with them. I said enter into it, but still not signed, is it, Jackie?
Yeah.
We're operating under an agreement that is unexecuted. Okay. But we went into an agreement with the other receivers to use UST. The other states, the receivers entered into this because before liquidation, they were continuing to process and pay claims. Beginning in August, the next Guaranty Association, which was Georgia, their company was put in liquidation. Well, the claims continued to be processed and paid by that same entity, and completely funded by the receivership state through early access. The Guaranty Association didn't fund anything, but the Guaranty Association in that state did step in and start approving batches and looking at problems. We'd already done most of the legwork and digging out this before the other receivers got involved, and the other Guaranty Associations got involved, and they did benefit a lot from all our work on this. So what happened July 7th? We entered into this agreement with UST HealthSource to be TPA, but they said, but any vendors, you've got to directly contract with them. We went through a vendor list of some 300. We ended up with about 30 vendors that we had directly entered a relationship with. And this is everything from City of Alamosa Utilities, janitorial service, elevator maintenance, all the way to Amazon Web Services for cloud, Dialpad for their phone system, which was several hundred thousand a month. It was expensive. So we have a process where we pay those vendors through the other five receiverships and this association, and then allocate the expenses. I do see every invoice and I approve them back through the other receivers. So it's been a very cumbersome process. It's working. What we have with UST HealthSource has two elements under two statements of work. One is statement of work one, which provides the platform, the base fee of $425,000 to allow us to use the system. Statement of work two are the labor, the people that are actually going to do the work. So they went out and offered positions and contracted with the former Friday Health Plans employees. They had targeted about 162 of them and ended up engaging and hiring about 105 of those employees. And then they passed along those expenses under the statement of work to the six insurance companies, including us, based on the salaries of those individuals, plus a 30% margin, plus a management fee. Pretty expensive, about $2 million a month. So we've been continuing under that relationship, but we will be ending statement of work two, the labor aspect of it, March 31st. It's going to end. Statement of work one, the access to the platform will continue. We will need that for a lot longer. Most of this association's work is wrapping up. We have paid or processed 144,879 claims. We're right at $21 million in benefit payments. We have about 800 appeals left to work. We think we can get most of those done. But to prepare for after the end of the statement of work two termination, we were able to work with UST for which of these people are you going to offer positions after 331 and which ones are you not. And the ones that they're not, we identified eight key people and we've gone out and offered them contracts. The contracts are to be shared among the it's actually the five entities. Nevada doesn't need them. The five states, but they are going to be contractors of Exam Resources, who is the special deputy receiver for three of the states. But it's under a contract that we work with NOLGA to develop, and Jackie is involved in that. Thank you. So we have an arrangement for eight key people, but we may need some more to do this work. And what we're doing right now is setting up a structure on how we will coordinate our efforts and allocate our cost after March 31st. So let me throw a couple more numbers at you and ask you for a little authority. Let me mention one good number. That's $25 million. December 9th, we got a $25 million distribution from the special deputy receiver here in Texas. Now, that's the good news. The bad news, we've already spent that money. And we've told the receiver we'd like to ask for some more. We're not going to ask for more until we know what we need right now. So we've spent the $25 million. We're using internal borrowing to continue the Friday operations. And so we're trying to come up with what we need. What's on the horizon? We have found there were about 375 providers that had payments issued to them pre-receivership for benefit payments. And for some reason, those benefit payments were never negotiated. Some were not delivered. We did some research. Some were missing a sweep number. Some the provider had changed and we didn't have a new W-9, so we didn't know where to send it. So Zealous, the payment processor for those, had returned those funds to the receivership. in prior experiences and what was happening before liquidation, after 90 days, Zealous would return those payments. The Friday team would start researching them, clean up it, send it back to Zealous, they'd be reissued. That was a finance department within Friday. Well, after July 7th, the Friday finance department was kind of gone. So when those payments came back from Zealous, they sat over here on a desk and nobody worked them. We found out about them through a Department of Insurance complaint and started digging into it. And that's where we started out with four. And then we found 376. So it's $1.18 million. We've just completed the research Monday, and all those are now in the process. About 80% of them W-9s have already been received. We are in process of putting them back into batches, and we'll be paying that $1.2 million. So those are going to get all cleaned up and paid. Then we have one other situation that's going to cost a little money. You recall I mentioned one of the standard practices, and Mr. Beeman will know this in his operation, provider overpayments do arise through processing. Through billing, through processing, you get provider overpayments. It is standard in the contracts that providers have with insurance companies that they are provided with notice on these overpayments and if the provider can dispute it or not. And if there's no dispute, the contracts allow that provider overpayments can be offset in future payments to that provider. Standard practice in the industry. It's not going to be standard in Texas receiverships.
Such a waste.
We've asked for that.
Why is it not standard?
SDR didn't want that.
Well, between the SDR and the Texas Department, we're going to work on that. But
they're probably not capable of actually managing that.
No, they can.
Now the SDR is saying we have to continue paying claims and they're going to see.
So in this insolvency, there's $30 million in provider overpayments. That was there when we got there. We were prepared to take those as, because they are assets of the estate. But if we credit them against our claim payments, we pay a net amount, which is standard practice. Whatever that amount that got offset, it's an early access distribution bus because we're responsible for the whole claim. Great. So what is, let's say it's a $200,000 payment. There's a $50,000 overpayment. What's $50,000 early access to us, but the receiver collects and didn't have to do a darn thing? It's collected. It's a clean process. We proposed that and it was rejected. So we had to go in and ask the system be reprogrammed to take out provider overpayments. And it was a nightmare to find out all the places you had to adjust this. Finally, they had to just put the provider overpayments to be applied like 20 years in the future. Well, okay, we won't take provider overpayments, but we also have a report because in continuing processing, new overpayments are being created. So we've been trying to track new overpayments. What we found out somewhere in all of this, there was a system check that was not caught. And provider overpayments have been credited against some of our payments without us knowing it. So we have paid net amounts. Potential exposure there is $4.9 million. It's about $5 million that we have underpaid because the overpayments were used. Now, the providers are fine. They're fine. The receiver is not.
Can we figure out a way to work that out with the receiver?
Because that's a receivership asset, and we just took it.
But it is a contractual, I don't know.
It's a contractual arrangement with the provider. Okay, but there's this relationship. Now you have the provider and the insurance. The insurance company is now bifurcated. What's receivership? They handle assets. They handle claims against the receivership. We handle provider claims, policy claims.
We should fit the statute on this because it's so inefficient.
I would like to ask our TDI colleagues. I know we've talked about this some before, but I think it might be a good time for us to sit down face-to-face with the SDR representatives and us and you all and talk about this issue a little bit.
We've just had to do the same thing in Bright. We had to turn off overpayment credits in Bright.
This is an issue we discussed recently.
Okay.
And so I think that would be a good idea.
So where are we in Friday? I committed to the SDR. So if it's in the system and it's happening, I am not going to try to change that system again. It's a moving target. If I try to turn it off, what else is it going to impact? I need to make sure providers are being paid. They're going to get paid and we'll work it out between us. So if I find that there's a provider overpayment credit was taken and the association paid a net amount, I'll pay you that amount that was taken. So I've committed to pay them the $5 million. Once we can confirm it, we're researching it, working through it now, but you have to do it claim by claim and then match it back to batches. And I have to see on the EOP if it was netted and that matches the net payment.
You're creating a problem for the providers because now they're going to get these letters from the SDR saying, you owe us this money. And they're going to go, what are you talking about? And their accounts receivable are going to have to go and figure out. It's creating a problem for the provider's accounting.
It's going to, because the SDR is pressuring us right now.
It's a work off for everybody.
The SDR is pressuring us to finish this provider overpayment research, which we're hopeful we're a couple of weeks away, so they can start collecting out overpayments. And one of the collection is, and this is where it's stupid, we're going to pay them $5 million. I'm going to turn right around and ask for early access and get paid the $5 million back.
It's, we're creating an accounting and administrative nightmare for everybody.
Right. But I need to make you aware it was a very convoluted, difficult process here and where we are on. So.
And I just want to emphasize too what Bart was saying about, you know, it seems like it would be an easy fix on these things. If the system is set up to, you know, credit overpayments, you just change the system so it doesn't do that. But Bart's right. Every time you do anything to that system, then all this other crazy stuff happens. And then you have to deal with all of that as
and
well.
I mentioned there are five other guarantee associations been activated for their Bright entities. They are taking provider overpayment credits in the processing of payment of their claims.
It's inconsistent.
Everyone else is fine. This is standard practice.
Right. Yes, it should be. I recommend that you revisit it.
Okay. So I just want to make you aware that that's the kind of thing that eats up our day.
Is it really a law issue or is it an interpretation issue?
I think it's an interpretation.
I think it's interpretation too. I'm concerned about putting it in the law because once you put it in law, that's kind of, it's in stone. If something changes, then you got a stone that's in contradiction with the process over here.
Well, this is dictated by the contract.
It's right. Yeah. It's the contract. It's
a contract.
But how does the contract fit within the SDR and the Guarantee Association's responsibilities?
Well, ours is responsible for paying a claim. The claims payment responsibility is tied to the broader contracts. And then all the systems are designed
The system puts the two together. And the receivership law bifurcates it. Claims over here, recoveries of overpayments over here.
And this interpretation is going to cause problems for providers' accounting offices.
Yep.
Or the additional work for the SDR. This doesn't seem to be reasonable.
Well, let me make it more complicated. We're making payments on claims. And there are challenges and appeals to that. We have to reprocess it. Oh, here's a new overpayment. But that overpayment was based on a claim that was funded and paid by the Guarantee Association. That is not a receivership asset.
That's right. Then why
do we got to track that?
Okay. That's not going through the receiver then.
Well, yeah, if we can identify. That's what's so complicated is trying to go through and trace all this. And I'm not talking about a handful. I'm talking about $5 million worth.
I don't mean to say it. It's a trade run. Oh, my God.
So that's what we do. So I want to give you color. Friday sounds simple. And when I mentioned we do.
Simple. It's never been simple.
Well, it's required a lot of time. Staff, Jarrett's been involved in all this. Topping's been involved in all this. Jackie and I, of course, have been knee-deep on this. Every one of these issues requires everyone on staff. And just so you know, everyone on your staff last year lost vacation time. We couldn't take all our time. We had too much work on it. So this was a taxing year. And it was because of Friday. We were just, it pushed our resources right up to the edge. So with all that, my complaining, I'm sorry, my apologies. I'm going to ask for some authority in a resolution here. And it specifically states that our agreement with UST Health Group is going to be ending March 31st. And I need the authority to make an alternative administrative arrangement. Yes. Part of it may be this contracting of these specific people, but depending on what's left in our block, I may need to have put our data onto a platform somewhere. And I have tentatively identified a platform that I can park it on for a fee and be able to look at this information and view it to resolve what's left. But I'm nowhere close to an agreement, and I'm still exploring all options. But I also don't want to commit to something if we can get our work done by March 31st. We're still trying to get it done. This is just give me some authority to keep things moving after March 31st, because you're not going to meet again until the end of April.
Well, I so move.
James Huckabee, second.
Any discussion?
You know, I wouldn't, I'd be remiss if I didn't look, reach out. If there's anything you think that I can do, and I bet Patty's going to throw her hat in the ring too. This is stuff we deal with all the time.
I know.
Reach out.
I appreciate that.
Let us at whatever color or advice or at least a sounding board.
Jackie, did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's all right. But he can't complain later when I call.
It's important to hear from the provider side. Yes. Because this position, I think, is going to create, and you're in a better spot to fix confusion for providers to get a letter from the special deputy receiver that they owe money to him. They're going to go, what are you talking about her? You know, I just think that it's going to make it.
Well, Mr. Beam, I appreciate that. Because one of the things we're exploring and doing right now, we've developed a mechanism to do en masse settlements. We have a couple of very large providers that have hundreds and hundreds of pending appeals and claims. And what we want to do is take all their information, ask them to scrub their accounts receivable, identify everything involving Friday, get them on that list. We will go through and verify what's been processed, denied, paid, member responsibility, get all that, and do an en masse settlement. Get it on the list. You are done in Friday. Boom, you're out of here. So we're in the process of working through that. We may end up have to ask you, is this a reasonable ask on some of that process?
Please do, because these are 100% negotiable.
Absolutely.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I think you're ready to call the question.
All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any opposed? And the motion carries.
Okay, let me.
Before you go.
Yes.
To the next one, I wanted to just take a second to give you all a brief update on the open records request that we got in connection with Friday. And I think Bart gave you some information in his interim management report about that. So that request came in, and I think they sent it to the department as well as the SDR, but the request came in on December 8th, so really poor timing. And you have 10 business days to respond. And I was pretty certain when I looked at it that, and the request was for all claim payments and denials and everything in Friday. And it came from an attorney. And I was pretty certain that we did not need to comply with that open records request as it was for an assortment of reasons. In consultation with Bart, I found an open records attorney to help evaluate that request and response to the attorney. And then we had to do a letter to the AG, you know, basically explaining why we think we don't need to provide these records. Well, in the course of doing all of that, I realized that attorney had actually emailed all of us who she submitted that open records request to last June and basically said, you know, who we contact about our claims on Friday or something to that.
And never disclosed who her clients were.
And right. And I had called her and left a voicemail message that said, you know, call me and let's talk about what you want to know, what's on your mind. And I didn't get a response by phone. And so I followed up with an email that said, you know, I left a message for you. Please get in touch with me and we can talk about whatever it is that you have. So the long and short of it was after in the response to that open records request, I reiterated our, you know, amenability to talking. And so, you know, it turned out to be a tempest in a teapot, but it was certainly a lot of time that could have been spent more productively otherwise. But I just wanted to give you an update on how that open records request was resolved. So the request itself is resolved. We are now dealing with the attorney and her provider clients who say that they haven't had any claims paid. And it turns out these are all out. There's 67 claims on their list and they're all out of network. And so
you make it sound so simple. Now, we can't mention the name of the client or the firm or anything, but when we said, send us your information, well, he sent four different files some 220 something claims, and a bunch of claims were 2023 dates of service, which there's no coverage policy for terminated. Started going through and I found all these duplicates. I said, can we get on the phone, Jackie? Get these people on the phone. Let's talk to them. He says, I'm going to send you a template spreadsheet. You fill in your information and do one spreadsheet for each tax identification number provider. I want it separated by, because they sent us a list of 27 providers, but not that in the claims. When it came back in, there were two providers. There were only 67 claims rather than the 220. And then they said, well, really only care about four of these claims. We'll take care of all 67. Now, we're moving down the road, and there are some issues that we need to work through with them. We're going to be having another call with them. It sounds simple, but every one of these takes a lot of time.
Your open records request was for every claim paid?
Yes. And it
regardless
wasn't.
Regardless of who it was fault to? It
wasn't limited to her clients.
Everything we've done.
It was ridiculous.
I'm curious, was that OOR withdrawn or did y'all respond to it?
We responded to it.
Yes.
We responded.
It hasn't been withdrawn. I am going to ask her to withdraw it, though.
Yeah.
Did you get an opinion from AG?
No. But we did, that's what our open records council said. I can't really remember now what this was actually called, but to submit a letter to the AG saying, we don't think we need to provide these records or seek an opinion for these reasons.
Yeah, we've done that several times.
Yes.
We've got to do that time too. I didn't know if it got back to you.
No, we've not heard from the AG on that.
Okay, moving on. I'll go quickly through this, and I apologize. It sounds kind of silly to go quickly through a $3 billion insolvency, but I am. Penn Treaty and American Network, where are we? First, this association, the numbers here haven't changed much other than the admin expenses because we pre-funded this $117.9 million. That's primarily the funding we sent to LTC Re, the captive that this and 45 other guarantee associations own in D.C. I still chair the administrative subgroup called PACA, Policy and Claims Administration, that is the front line with the TPA working on day-to-day activities, any policy administration. So what's important here as a whole or the system, and these numbers are as of, I think I put them in here, December 31st, you can see for all the guarantee associations, excluding Illinois, Wisconsin, and Hawaii, because they're doing their own administration outside of the rest of us, $566 million collected premiums, is that $32 million for Texas, $1.5 billion payments for everyone, $82 million for Texas, and then cash buyouts. These were cash buyouts as part of our rate increase program we implemented. $133 million were paid by the other GAs, $6 million for us. So what's left? There are about 34,200 policies for everyone. Remember, we started at 71,000 in March of 2017, and there's 3,800 open claims. And on in-force policies for us, 1785 and 265 open claims. So the reduction in policies, and I have all these graphs and things. I put in a quarterly report on administration that I send to the LTC Re Board of Directors. we're down 51% of policies that we started with. We're only down 41% on claims. And claims are actually now kind of climbing up again. We're at that point on this block that we're close to the peak, but claims are going to stay up for a while. This is a very old block. Average age is 83.
Yeah.
Average age on claim is over 86.
And wasn't there once one person that was 110?
Yeah, 110. Yeah, she finally passed.
She did.
Yes.
I mean, it's amazing the longevity changes, which is why I guess they went insolvent partly good.
So I'm putting in here some things that PACA has been working on. Service level standards. We have a TPA contract that has 25 service level standards that we monitor monthly, but we calculate them quarterly to see has the TPA met those standards. If they don't meet the standards, there are financial penalties built into the contract. There were two penalties that came up involving some customer satisfaction surveys. That's for claims payment and claims management. Come to find out, the surveys had not been distributed as intended. So we started digging into it and working with PACA, my group, and the Coordination and Strategy Committee that I also serve on, and the LTC Board of Directors. We agreed those surveys need to be reworked. They were too cumbersome. They were long. We weren't getting good responses. And the information we were getting didn't serve a purpose. So we spent over a year. And we just recently have approved two very simple three-question surveys for both of those. And they've not yet been implemented, but they're in process. So spent a lot of time on that. We, other than those issues with those two surveys, Davies met all the other service level standards. In my personal view, customer service and customer satisfaction surveys are good to have. Should you make them a measurement standard for financial penalties under a contract? I'm not so sure. Because all you're going to hear from are really the negative people. And there's a lot of other metrics that we measure that really show performance. And at the same time, complaints are so low. We see maybe 3 or 4 a month. And when you're talking about almost 4,000 claims, that's incredible. Okay. Two other programs are in process. The wellness pilot program is continuing. We're in the second year of it, doing some re-engagement. We've had a lot of interventions delivered. We're seeing good success and positive responses from the policyholders. We've not yet seen that come across. We just started seeing it in the last 6 months in claims activity. So reduced claims because people are staying at home longer. So we're seeing less facility claims and we're seeing an overall reduction in claims. So the money is being spent in intervention is changing the claims curve a little bit, but it's been much slower than what you would see in wellness for managed care. Long-term care just takes longer to kick in. The other program, there's electronic visit verification. I was a huge proponent of this program after I killed the program that they had in place at Penn Treaty. When we got there, they had almost a handful of people on it. It was very discriminatory. I didn't like it. I was worried about our liability in continuing it, so I killed it. We went through an RFP program. This program was, this vendor was selected in March. And then we expanded the program last June. And right now, you can see we have 386 cases being referred, 218 are in the program. I just had a status call on this last Friday. We're up to about 260 now in the program. And we're seeing good results. Where we used to have red flags come up that manually we would identify, hey, this is a potential fraud, waste, and abuse issue. We need to dig into it. Jackie and I are involved with one. It took 4 years to identify that this was a problem. By the time we caught it, we'd already paid out $204,000. And we got the people to surrender the policy. They didn't even argue. They surrendered the policy. And I said, well, we're going to need some restitution. I can't prove everything. I asked him for $30,000. I thought it'd be a negotiation. Next thing I saw, here's a cashier's check.
They didn't even get in trouble.
We did report that within the guidelines to TDI as well. If we had had this program in place, it wouldn't have taken 4 years. It would have taken 3 or 4 months for this to bubble up through EVV because the providers have to go in there and they use an app to record when they get to the claimant's home and what they're doing and when they check out. And they also are very aware that GPS pings them regularly throughout that. And we know if they're not in that home, or if they're checking in from someone else or checking out later from somewhere else. And we've identified, we go through about 30 cases a month now, potential fraud. We've already ordered 4 cases, have ordered additional surveillance. But the geofencing component of this is really paying off. And it's not to be the gotcha to catch people doing wrong. It has that element, but it's also a deterrent. We now have much tighter reporting that the caregivers are reporting exactly when they get there and exactly when they leave. 15 or 30 or 45 minutes here and there adds up on a claim. Okay. When you're paying these people anywhere from $20 to $35 an hour. So the program continues. I'll have more to report later, but it is really working well. I always put in here how many policyholders have exhausted their Erie Association coverage. And it is important to note, out of all the states, I mentioned 30,000 policyholders almost 40,000 policyholders had dropped off. We no longer have those. Only 755 policyholders have exhausted Guaranty Association coverage limits. And remember, this is in a time when two of those states only had $100,000 of coverage for long-term care. So the $300,000 of coverage that many people say is inadequate for Guaranty Association protection of long-term care is working quite well. Spent a lot of time in the last 6 months. We did a claims audit. The claims auditor was a firm, actually. It's a long-term care firm here in Austin. We know pretty well. They did a very good job. It was a very, very clean audit, but there was some work to be done on changing some letters, language in letters on waiver premium restoration of benefits and to make sure the appeal language is a little bit cleaner. And then we had to look at a couple of processes. I won't get into these because they're very complicated, but we decided after some detailed review and running some numbers that the practices in place were appropriate. The policies have some interpretive differences, but we didn't make any changes in the policy. So claims audit worked out well, and we're just continuing in our work. I have started to put the LTC Reboard and the NOLGA task force on notice that someone's got to start transitioning my role to be everything I do on pin treaty, because I still do pin treaty every day. And once a month, I do reports, and we have a monthly call with Davis. I do the agendas. I do all the analysis of the metrics for that, and then I do the quarterly report to all the Guaranty Associations, to the LTC Reboard, and the NOLGA Task Force. And the reports that come out, you just don't copy and paste them. I have all these tracking schedules that I feed the numbers into, and then I produce summaries and written explanations and graphical depictions. Someone's got to take this over.
Yeah, what percentage of the claims are Texas policyholders now versus others? So somebody else needs to raise their hand, and that's a lot of work.
And it was interesting.
In 7 years.
It was interesting. The chief operating officer of the LTC RE and the chairman of the board, who used to be with
United,
you know him really well, very qualified, asked me recently if the additional compensation I was getting was sufficient. I said, what? He says, don't you get an hourly rate for doing that? No, I get a base salary from my association. NOLGA doesn't pay anything, and LTC RE doesn't pay me anything to do that work. Says, really? Okay. So they are very aware. Probably the next person, they're going to have to engage someone to do what I'm doing for PACA. So I put them on those.
You're too nice. Probably should have suggested that a long time ago.
That's okay. It all comes out of the wash, and part of my job here is to support the system nationally. Okay, so that's Penn Treaty. I'll move on. North Carolina Mutual. Messy life insurance insolvency out of North Carolina. We have a very small piece of it. The only thing I want to mention in this is there was a recent negotiation that was concluded I didn't know it was going to get done this quickly because I'm not on this task force, but it involved North Carolina's participation in the Federal Employee Group Life Insurance Program, FEGLI. And in FEGLI, North Carolina was writing these policies, and there's a coinsurance arrangement a reinsurance agreement and a conversion pool that MetLife provides to the FEGLI program. Well, as part of North Carolina Mutual's termination of participating in that program, something had to be done with all these FEGLI policies that were already on North Carolina Mutual paper. So the task force negotiated 100% coinsurance agreement with Metropolitan Tower Life to handle those obligations. Now, as part of that 100% coinsurance, someone's got to pay Metropolitan Tower the reserves on this. It was negotiated and agreed the North Carolina Mutual receiver would pay that from estate assets. So we're being asked to participate in this 100% coinsurance agreement and the early access. So these obligations will be handled. They're still on Guaranty Association's direct responsibility, but 100% will be addressed and paid by Metropolitan Tower Life, and the estate funds everything. So it's no cost to us, and it's just a cleanup of the FEGLI component of this receivership. So there's a resolution I'll put on screen that was not in your material because I just had to develop it after this was announced last week.
Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Ted, second.
Flip coin.
Where's Mark?
No, Mark won.
Sorry, Ted.
Ted, you're not here.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. And the last company I'll mention, Southland National, and I keep it on here because it was one of the three global companies along with Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers Life. Southland National was the one that was put into liquidation, and the contesting that was raised by GBIC, the holding company, was overturned by the court. So we continue to see batches of claims come in twice a month. We've only paid out $424,000. There's no action necessary here. This is just a reporting. And I will mention that I was contacted by the Department of Banking here in Texas on this because a lot of these policies were also prepaid burial contracts. And the prepaid burial seller is regulated by the Department of Banking. And they contacted me because we've known each other back from the Lincoln Memorial Service insolvencies, and they were concerned, is there a growth component in these contracts? Does the death benefit grow? So when the benefits are paid under the insurance policy, will it meet the obligations of the prepaid contracts for the funeral homes? And so I audited the policy forms, and then the first three or four batches came through. I got the details of the processing from the TPA and went through, and everything matched up to the penny. Some of these have a flat percentage that in the interest rate that the death benefit does grow over time. Other, it's a tabular, so the death benefit grows tabular over time, but it does provide for, they like to call it, the Department of Banking, a growth element. So a prepaid burial contract that was entered into 10 years ago at a certain price for that individual, it's going to pay a higher benefit now. Well, the insurance policy benefit is also higher, so they match up pretty well. So the Department of Banking has been quite happy and thanked us for doing the audit. It was just a handful of claims, and we moved on. So another thing, behind the scenes, some of the little additional testing we have to do. And the last thing I'll mention is just a public record of a decision that we will need to address after a executive session presentation discussion. This involves the association's position on how we cover and what amount of cover we provide to jointly owned deferred annuities. This is not an obscure topic. It's something we get calls on all the time because it's very common for a husband and wife to maybe individually own annuities, but also together own annuities. And they want to know, how does Guaranty Association coverage apply? What amount are we covered? So this issue had been raised as a theoretical issue back in 2011, and a position promoted by the NOLA Coverage Claims Committee. That was recently revisited because questions that had come up and also identified this is going to be a real issue in the Colorado Bankers Life insolvencies. There are some of these annuities. So Coverage Claims Committee, by the way, I did not serve on it back in 2011. I do serve on it now. It was reconsidered this year, and a new recommended position has been sent out to the Guaranty Association for consideration, and they are asked to respond with their decisions by March 31st. So those coverage interpretations can be calculated and implemented in preparation for the possible liquidations of Bankers and Colorado Bankers. So that is an overview of the issue and why we're looking at it now. The details will involve a legal presentation and opinion from Jackie, so we'll deal with that in executive session.
Didn't NOLA have agreement with ACLI?
We'll talk about that in executive session.
Okay.
And that's all I had under item 10, and that is everything I have for open session at this point.
Okay, do we want to take like a 10-minute break?
After you close the session?
Yeah.
Yep.
The time is 10:36 a.m. on January 30th, 2024, and I'm recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association in order for the board to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas. The time is 12:44 on January 30th, 2024. The executive session of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association Board of Directors meeting has concluded, and I'm reconvening the regular session of the meeting pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. And
I have some resolutions ready for you to consider for actions after executive.
12 on the agenda. So the first one is resolution on 457B plan payment to the executive director to make his contribution this year, $23,000. Do I have?
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you. And this next resolution is to enter to an agreement with Jackie as per her engagement letter to provide general counsel services for TLHIGA for 2024.
It's James Huckabee. So moved.
Patty, second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 This action may need a little bit of explanation for me very quickly. We talked in executive session about Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers Life. What we did not talk about is just preparing when the liquidation orders become final and effective. There is already a timeline of Guarantee Association scheduled activities. And one of those, or a couple of those, would involve first engaging a TBA to handle the payout of these annuity contracts. And it looks like the opt-out deadline may be March 31st for that. This is giving me the authority to participate in that administration agreement with the TBA. Just so you know, they did come to me recently, they being the task force, asked me to serve on the administration subgroup, even though I'm not on the task force, to help negotiate this contract and then to devise an audit of their processes and do a testing of the payout, so we can run samples of the payout before there's a run on the bank, because you pay out the wrong amount, it's out the door, you're not getting it back. So I've agreed and I've started serving on that working group. So this would allow us to participate in the service agreement with the BPA and an early access agreement with the two receivership estates, because they did say they are going to have some funds to share with the Guarantee Associations very soon.
So do we have a motion to?
I'll move.
Mark, second.
Brian?
Oh, you said.
Yeah, Jim Harrison.
I didn't hear a motion.
Jim Harrison was the first. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any opposed? Thank you.
There were no other actions identified coming out of executive session.
Okay, so item number 13 is financial and accounting matters.
So, Jarrett, if you would touch on a couple of highlights of the financial statements, and then I think the highlights on the budget, and we can ask them to take action. Oh,
whoa.
Ooh,
your financial statements.
I wondered if I was the only one that had that.
They didn't convert properly, Jarrett, so.
Yeah.
Let me look and see real quick if I can bring up another version.
This is what page are you on? Mine looks okay.
Okay, hang on just a second.
This
He's from the website. They're okay.
You're on an Apple and I'm on an Apple.
You know what it is?
This has happened once.
It was actually.
Yeah, because mine looks good.
Hang on just a second. I think it was sharing in preview. So let me move.
I'll just get it on that.
Here we go.
Looks good.
Let me change the display real quick, Jarrett. Give me just a moment.
Somebody was drinking when I printed that out.
Okay, Jarrett, run with it.
All right. So I'll try to make this real quick. So first note up there, we've told y'all before, and this is in because of the Friday and the Bright insolvencies, we're trying to move money into cash to be able to fund these claims quickly. So we've had some treasury maturities, and we're moving them into this Morgan money account that the board authorized, I believe, two meetings ago. We're getting comparable returns, so we're not really losing out on doing that, and it's allowing us to fund these claims quickly. The second point there, if y'all recall, at the last meeting, you authorized us to write off some old assessments and the allowance. So you'll see the impact of that there from September to October there in that build assessment net of allowance amount. We've had some, let's look down at the unbilled assessments amount and the insurance contractual obligations there. That third note, the increase in those, mostly due to the Friday insolvency. We keep trying to find a good obligations number for those. I think Bart's finally got a good one this time. The note there in the middle about the accounts payable, those are just some odd things that happened. The $841,000 in November was due to a timing issue on claims. We funded the claims on the end of the month, and the vendor didn't pull the money out until the following month. So it's all cleared up following the month. So if we go to the next page, look there. It's kind of the same thing. These are the income statement changes of the unbilled assessment and contractual obligations we talked about on the balance sheet. These changes are just mostly due to the changes in the Friday insolvency obligations. All right, the next page. We have a same thing, increase in unbilled assessments and contractual obligations here on the cash flow statement, and that's all brought from Friday. So that's quickly the financial statements, unless there are any questions. Okay, so on page 13.9, we have the budget for 2024. As part of this, in the explanations, I give y'all a written explanation of anything that's over a 10% change from the prior year. So all that's been written out in this section. I do want to touch on two items. If you look at,
okay, go ahead. Sorry. Okay.
If you look at legal for the estate, 5075 legal estate, you'll see a very significant increase in the budget for 2024. That is actually about 75% of our actual expenses for 2023. Due to Friday and Bright, we've had a significant increase in legal expenses. And so we have upped the budget for that for the next year in anticipation of some of those expenses continuing. And on top of that, there's also the fact that we don't have board counsel, so general counsel will be taking some of those expenses on as well. I'll look at line item 5085, national assessments. We have a fairly significant increase there. This is always our biggest budget item. That is due to the anticipated increase in the global companies that are coming in 2024. So we've increased our budget a little bit for that as well. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them.
So, Jarrett, there, the $2.4 million, that's our operating budget.
Yeah, we separate interest out because due to GASB 87, where we're having to book some interest. And because that also includes treasury interest when we purchase treasuries, we just really don't include that kind of in our operating budget. But it does need to be accounted for, so it is there. So really, our operating budget is about $2.4 million.
And that's variable and the fixed.
Yeah, so on the variable and the fixed, so the variable are expenses that we think are will result from insolvency activity alone. So the $663,000 is going to be all insolvency activity. We keep $11,000 out because that's part of our expenses for the assessment data survey. On the $5,000 there, you know, we think $5,000 of that total number is going to be due strictly to insolvency work. So if we add all that up, about 32-33% of our budget is strictly from insolvency. And the other 67 is fixed expenses that we would have if we had no insolvency activity.
So really, if you look at operating overhead, that's $1.5 million.
Yeah. Now this is not what we actually charge to the insolvencies, because we won't know that until we've actually done the work and put in the hours. But this is our anticipated amount that we think will be a result of insolvency alone.
And so the full board knows this is projected. When we meet with the audit committee, we always give them an update on budgeted to actual. And it at their meeting in April each year, we recast the prior year. So when they meet in April, we'll give them 2023. Here's the way it finally shook out. We budgeted this much. Here's how much were the actual expenses. And that's a good tool to help us as we move forward and budget the next year.
And we'll actually do a breakout of actual amounts charged to insolvency work versus non-insolvency work.
Right.
All right. So next page, capital budget's real simple. We don't have anything projected. Our cutoff is $2,500 in a year or longer. So we don't have anything that we think we're going to spend that will exceed that. And there's all the budget assumptions. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer. If not, we have a resolution to accept the budgets as presented.
I have a motion.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any opposed? Thank you.
And the next item is just the date. And there, we need to clarify, Jim. We normally meet on Tuesdays. We changed the April meeting date to Monday, April 22nd, because this room is booked. It's booked a lot in April. So we could barely squeeze in Monday the 22nd. We hope that works for everyone to have this meeting on a Monday rather than a Tuesday.
I would have to be out by 12:20.
We will get it done, David.
Yeah,
okay.
I can do this. 22nd.
I'll be remote.
Okay.
I'll have to be remote. I have board. My board meets the fourth Monday of every month.
Well, if enough people have conflicts, we Toffee could look and see what else there is for this room, but it was pretty tight.
We could do it again. If you recall, we reviewed in November when this originally happened, but if your schedules have changed, we can try to work around that.
Yep. If that's where it is for now, Jim. Monday, the 22nd of April.
Okay. So you really need to enjoy this next thing you're about to say, Jim.
Yes.
Yeah, it's your last time.
Yes. The time is 12:58 on January 30th, 2024, in this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act is adjourned.